This is NPR's All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The trial of President Clinton and the discussion of it have featured some uses and abuses of English that are familiar to us from the courtroom. The Democrats wanted to set a date certain for it to end. Not a certain date, but a date certain. Adjective after the noun, as in French. French word order is not part of everyday speech, unless we're speaking every day about accounts payable or receivable, a court-martial, the attorney general, or a notary public. This is the language of lawyers, which law professor and linguist Peter Tiersma studies and deplores. In this strange tongue, vestigial ease survive, turning squires into esquires, states into estates, and the common verb to stop into estop. Speakers favor such Latinate words as commence and initiative, and initiate, rather, when the simple begin would do just as well. In his book, Legal Language, Peter Tiersma writes that most of the damage came after the Norman conquest. French was the language of the law, but not necessarily of the land. In fact, some legal phrases that are pairs of words that mean the same thing, free and clear, for example, are early efforts at bilingualism.
You never knew whether the person who was reading this would be a better French speaker or an English speaker. Many people were bilingual, but other people at the time spoke only English or French. And so if you had a phrase like breaking and entering, where one is break is an English word, Anglo-Saxon word, and enter is a Romance or French word, you would be more or less guaranteed that people would understand either one of those two terms. Some of the other examples are devise and bequeath, where devise is French and bequeath is English. Breaking and entering, acknowledge and confess, where acknowledge is English and confess is French. Goods and chattels, where goods is the original Anglo-Saxon word. Will and testament, that redundancy that we get on the top of almost every will, even today.
Well, it seems quite sensible for the year 1300 or whatever to have said will and testament. But how does a totally pointless redundancy remain in use well toward the eve of the 21st century?
That's a really interesting question, and I think at least part of it has to be the general conservatism of the profession. In fact, if you think about that phrase, the full phrase that you find on top of wills typically is last will and testament. And so it's not just redundant, but you've got to ask yourself, what does that word last contribute to this? If you go to a lawyer, and you ask for that lawyer to draft your first will, the lawyer is going to put last will and testament at the top, even though it's your first. And if you go and have another will made, it's also going to be entitled. It's not going to be second will and testament, even though it's your second will, and it's all tradition. And it's got to be more, I would think, than just conservatism. That's a large part of the answer. Lawyers tend to be very conservative. They tend to be very cautious. Lawyers very often say, well, if this worked in the past, you know, I put last will and testament on the top and I used all this arcane language. Now I have to write another will. Well, I'll just use the words that I used last time. And that tends to foster a continual recycling of these forms over and over and over again.
As you pick apart the charge to the jury by Judge Lance Ito in the murder trial of O.J. Simpson, and among other things that you quote him saying are, the line, and this would be common for many charges to jurors in criminal cases in California, I guess, failure of recollection is a common experience, and innocent misrecollection is not uncommon.
That is one of my favorite examples to illustrate how arcane jury instructions can be sometimes. Yeah, think of that phrase, failure of recollection is a common experience. And I've asked my students sometimes, well, what does that mean exactly? Can you say that in ordinary language? And they tend to hem and haw for a while before finally someone tells me what it actually means. And, of course, all that it really means is people sometimes forget things. And the point that I try to make in this book is, well, if that's all it means, why not just say so? And another example that really, in a sense, bothers me is the definition of reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. So if you go a little further in Judge Ito's instruction, he tries to define, this is, of course, the critical concept a lot of times, and the critical question in an awful lot of criminal cases is reasonable doubt. Was there reasonable doubt or not? And here's how Judge Ito defines that. Reasonable doubt is defined as follows. It is not a mere possible doubt, because everything relating to human affairs is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. That's not too bad. But then he goes on. It is that state of the case which, after the entire comparison and consideration of all the evidence, leaves the minds of the jurors in that condition that they cannot say they feel an abiding conviction of the truth of the charge. Now, that's awfully hard.
Thanks a lot, Judge. Thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah, and juries come back and they say, Your Honor, could you explain that in layman's terms? And a judge just rereads the same instruction to them because the judge is afraid if I change just one word, I'm going to get overturned on appeal.
Isn't it possible that the concept of reasonable doubt, as opposed to another courtroom standard, clear and convincing evidence, and yet another standard, preponderance of the evidence, that actually they really don't mean that much when you try to parse them, and that's why we get all the fuzzy language, because the concepts are flawed?
That is very often a problem, and one reason I think that lawyers tend to be very hesitant to write things in plain language, to deviate from what they've used in the past. Because in order to write something in plain, ordinary language, you have to understand exactly what it means. And a lot of these terms, in fact, are fuzzy, and they are somewhat unclear. I know this because I happen to be on a task force in California, which is taking these jury instructions and is trying to write them in ordinary language. And often we have debates about what exactly this means. And until you understand it well enough, you simply can't translate it into ordinary language.
Isn't there an issue here that if lawyers and judges spoke ordinary language, then they wouldn't instantly be recognized as lawyers and judges? They'd just sound like the rest of us, and therefore their status before the bar wouldn't be instantly recognized.
That is something that actually I think is also a very important factor as to why this legalese or legal language has survived for so long. It's a way of indicating to other people in the profession that you're a member of the club or the fraternity. And one of my favorite examples of that is the word defendant, pronounced as defend, you know, as though you were defending ants, the insects. And that's a very odd pronunciation, defend ant. It sounds unnatural, very unnatural to me. And I used to be a phonologist back in my earlier days. The proper or at least the normal pronunciation is defendant. But you find law students and even law professors and even some journalists who have been following the law quite a bit begin to pronounce this word as defendant. And the only explanation I can think of is it's a subtle way of signaling that you're a member of the legal fraternity.
Peter Tiersma, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Peter Tiersma's book is called Legal Language.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Today, murder charges against Dr. Eugene Turner of Port Angeles, Washington, were dismissed without prejudice. The 62-year-old pediatrician had been accused of the second-degree murder of three-day-old Connor McInerney. The child was rushed to the emergency